The following class was led by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 16, 2001. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, this is our last talk on Katagiri Roshi's book. For the entire series, all three, these were spread out over three classes over the last 3 years. Some of you have been here for all of this, but now we're going to wrap it up here. Tonight we'll cover the epilogue and the appendix. Zen in Everyday Life, the epilogue, and the Art of Zazen for the appendix. So here on page 163, Katagiri Roshi said, to practice Zen in everyday life, you must pay attention to the existence of others. And it dawned on me that this, you might think that this is about kind of snooping on others or something like that. And of course, that isn't at all what he means. But, you know, very often this is how we attend to others, is in kind of a busybody way. You know, we're wondering about what they're doing and what they're practicing and what they're thinking, and we're attending to others. You know, we're paying attention to the existence of others in this fashion, which of course isn't at all what he means. And on the other hand, what it is that we need to be doing is attending to ourselves in that fashion. What are you thinking? You know, we don't pay attention to this. And this is what Zazen entails, that we need to be paying attention to ourselves in these ways. But as for others, we simply need to be aware of their existence, that they are there. And that they are not there as something apart from you. You're never alone in that regard. You're always with others, and it is impossible to practice without other, and this is what he's speaking of here. So to practice Zen in everyday life, you must pay attention to the existence of others. To practice our way, you have to practice with all sentient beings. And this probably takes a while to really learn. I mean, intellectually, I think we can get the idea of this pretty quickly. But to actually understand this and to realize that these aren't just words, this is how it is. This is how it is in reality. Whether you practice meditation or not, whatever it is that you are doing, you are always doing it inseparable from other. And inseparable in such a way, for those of you who have had our Nagarjuna classes, you realize then that your very own identity is tied up in that other, can't be pulled out. And this is what is really going on. This is the reality of our lives. And when we practice meditation, sooner or later, if we are really practicing this, if we are really finally awakening to what it is that we are actually doing in this moment, which is what the meditation is, it really has nothing to do with sitting in a cross-legged position or any of the other things that we closely associate with meditation. If we really understand what this meditation is, it is to realize just that, how it is that you actually exist here. And you don't exist here as yourself. So he said, to practice our way, you have to practice with all sentient beings. And then he goes on to say, the Zen in everyday life, and everyday life and Zen are not two different things. And this particular title here, Zen in Everyday Life, if you may have noticed, and I talked about this 2 years ago when we began the book, it mirrors the prologue, which is Zen in Everyday, Everyday Life and Zen. And now we have Zen in Everyday Life. And these two particular sections, I mentioned this 2 years ago, came from the November Sesshin, 1978. And I remember it quite clearly because this was just a few days after I discovered I had cancer. And I was the eno for that Sesshin. And I remember I went in and told Katagiri Roshi that I had cancer, and it turned out before the Sesshin actually began that I found out it was pretty bad, and I didn't have, my chances were pretty slim. So I went into that session with a very intense mind. no distraction there. And it meant quite a bit to me. I know that he broke off with what he was going to speak on that day, or those days for the session. And he gave us these two beautiful lectures that I thought would be very appropriate for these end pieces to this book. So I just, a little personal note there. But this is a very beautiful teaching that he's given us here. Zen and everyday life in Zen. These are not two different things, he said. These are one, just like a Japanese folding fan, he says. And using this image, he said that the pivot, this is Zen practice, is this pivot of the fan. It must be open. To work as a fan, it must be open. This pivot, this is Zen practice, must be open to everyday life. This is the opening of the fan. He says, not just your daily life, but the daily life of others as well, because this is the actuality of your life. It isn't your life that you're living alone. He'll repeat this again and again, as he has actually in various places throughout this book. But this is a very important point to understand. And I don't expect you to understand it just by listening to this here or in reading Katagiri Roshi's book. But to come back to this, to remind yourself, you hear him speak in this way. And from time to time, it might at some point dawn on you just what it is that you are doing. It is not something that we need to make a big deal out of. It is, of course, wonderful and boundless, limitless. But the moment we make a big deal out of it, we make it into something ordinary. And all of this is taking place within our mind. And this is what we need to be watching for and to seeing. And this is actually to, once again, to pull ourselves out from the world, away from others, and to live in our ordinary mind. This is not Zen practice, and this is not taking care of daily life. He said, your practice will help you and others to become one with the earth, with nature, with all things. So this is a very subtle point that he's raising here. And then he goes on to say, Zen teaches full concentration and no attachment. He said, but this might seem paradoxical. And it might seem paradoxical, but if we look carefully, as he says in the next sentence, full concentration means to throw yourself completely away. So, not so paradoxical after all. Full concentration is, with full concentration, once again, you come to the realization that you are not something separate and removed from other, that you exist here together. Not even, it's even more unified than that. But you exist here inseparable from all of this. This comes with full concentration. And it means to throw yourself completely. He says throw yourself completely away. But really, with this full concentration, the self just simply drops away. You really can't throw it away. Sometimes we talk like that. But we have to understand this is not a deliberate act on your part. That is the throwing away part. The deliberate act on our part is to bring ourselves into this moment. And if we truly come into this moment, the self drops away. And this is what is taking place. But this thing about throwing yourself completely away, he says, this sounds negative. Forget yourself and jump into Zazen. But this negative expression of human life manifests in the affirmative, that is, in no attachment. So no attachment. And this is, he calls this the affirmative. No attachment means peaceful, harmonious life. It is living in reality as things truly are, in which you are not separated out, removed, and apart from other. This is actually how we live, and what he's speaking of here is coming to that realization and that understanding. Again, this is not just you know, having an idea of what it is that he's speaking of here. But just to allow yourself slowly, gradually through this practice, through coming back to these teachings, reminding yourself again and again of what we're doing, and just bring yourself back to this moment. Gradually we will wake up to what is truly taking place here. Okay, then he says, if you study Zen, you may find seemingly paradoxical expressions, such as this thing about full concentration and no attachment. But then he says, for instance, he says, see the flower without seeing it. He says, but how can you do that? How can you see the flower without seeing it? You notice he doesn't bother to explain it here. Can you say how you can see a flower without seeing it? Now, how do we normally see a flower? Do we really see a flower when we see a flower? Is it possible that maybe if we truly see a flower, we're not seeing a flower? And this is what he's speaking. I'll let you think. He doesn't say, I'm not going to say either, mainly because I can't say. He can't say either. There's nothing we can say. We can say a lot of words that kind of dance around this a little bit. But I think we've given some indication of this already. It's a matter of when you see the flower, realize that you're not separate from a flower. There's no you looking at a flower. There's no flower apart from this experience in this moment. But he gives another example of this kind of paradoxical statements that we run into. He said, Dogen Zenji says, when you let go of everything, you get everything in your hand. Zen expression. When you let go of everything, you get everything in your hand. He said, this is the real teaching of Zen. But we don't quite trust that, because we're still holding on to something. We're holding on to the practice. We're holding on to this teaching. We're holding on to something here. We don't quite trust this, but maybe we trust it enough to continue with the practice, continue contemplating these kinds of teachings. But gradually, maybe we will learn to just trust this, to let this go. This is the dropping away of body and mind, this throwing yourself completely away that he was speaking of earlier. He said the point is, but he said this is the real teaching of Zen, to let go of everything is to get everything in your hand. He said the point is not to make you confused. Sounds paradoxical, but the point is not to make you confused. Sometimes people think that Zen teachings are just there to confuse us, you know, so that we'll give up on trying to figure out what our experience is. Well, it isn't here just to make you confused. It's actually pointing to directly to what your experience is. He said, explanations of Zen seem paradoxical, but Zen itself is not paradoxical, because Zen itself goes right to the heart of the matter. It draws our attention exactly to what is taking place here. And he says you can experience this directly. And this is what Zen then is about. It's not about explaining something or understanding it in verbal terms or in any other way, where you're situated off from whatever it is that's being explained. Nothing is actually explained in that way, because nothing in reality is actually separate and removed from anything else. This is something that can be seen directly, and Zen is about learning to do just that, and learning to do this without abandoning or throwing away, you know, our intellect or any of the rest of it. We still have our conceptualizing mind. But we don't need to be taken in in such a way that we are looking for the truth, looking for reality in an idea or a thought of some sort, where we make arguments and observations and offer explanations. Okay, a little further down, he said that the practice of full concentration and no attachment is not just for yourself. Again, he repeats this. It is for all sentient beings. He said, do you believe that you can have a clear and serene mind in Zazen while ignoring the lives of others? He said, you cannot. The sense that your practice is just your individual practice is really egoistic. You think about that for a moment. And it's really egoistic. Now, don't feel bad that you practice in this way if you do, and you probably do, because this pretty natural for us to practice in this way. And it takes quite a while for us to really taste the subtlety of what it is that he's pointing to here. And you shouldn't feel bad that maybe you haven't really tasted this. It is very good, in fact, if you can. And this is how we cure ourselves of this egoistic mental disease that we have, by noticing how it is that we always bring this self into the experience. Always everything is interpreted in terms of this self, and then wanting to please this self and all the rest of that. So it's just simply a matter that we become aware of this and realize that this is going on. And at that point, it will drop away of its own. He said that your praxis, it's egoistic. Oh, and then he gives an example then, too, of how if we don't understand this practice and how it operates, you get into a lot of danger here, a lot of difficulty, not just with you personally, but also socially, and in many different ways that this can cause a lot of trouble for us. And we can begin to use Zen training and practice and concentration. If we don't really understand it, it becomes a very dangerous thing. It gives us an example in World War II. If all the government was telling people, use this Zen training to kill people. And he said, this will support Japan. But he said, does Japan live alone and they exist alone in the universe? He said, no, of course not. Nothing does. Not Japan, not you, not the stone, not whatever it is we want to discuss here. So he said, don't misunderstand. We cannot lose sight of this inseparability of you as a practicer here in this moment. So he said, don't misunderstand Zen teachings. They become very dangerous if we do. And that's what he says, a partial understanding can be very dangerous. And also, too, we begin to get understandings of this and that. Usually it's all very intellectual stuff. We might not quite realize it. It's based on how we feel about this or that, perhaps. Seems intuitive, maybe. But it's all intellectual stuff, and it's very egoistic as well, because you're in the picture. And but this is all partial understanding. When you have a complete understanding, a thorough understanding of Zen practice, all of these things that he's been describing here have dropped away, and it is not it's no longer a danger anyway. So he says a partial understanding can be very dangerous. He said you might then use Zen teachings to support your ego, and this is commonly done, and in fact perhaps more commonly done than not. People will use this to support your ego. It doesn't matter that it's common or not common. The point is, like, once again, as always, what you are doing with your mind, and you could continue on in an ordinary way, acquire some training with Zen, and now continue to use it in an egoistic way, not really realizing that actually this training, this practice, this teaching is about liberating you, freeing you of this problem. We have to be acquainted, or at least familiar, to know somewhere in this is a very subtle point that we need to finally come to, arrive at, and digest. And take it in, make it our own, make it complete. So we have a complete understanding. We are no longer acting for self. He says you have to love all human beings. He said, and then you can put Zen teachings into practice in the world. He said then Zen teaching can really work in peace and harmony. And in fact, then Zen teachings can really work. So until that, you should just be watching yourself, taking hold, taking a grip, obtaining some power of some sort or other that you might think you have, or that maybe you do have, but you have a poor grasp of it, and you're using it in a poor way. Best just to let all that sit, because you don't really need to do anything with this. All we really need to do is to learn to come back to this moment again and again. And at some point, we will realize what it is that we're doing. and what it is that is going on here. Until that point, just continue to practice bringing yourself back to this moment. That's all we need to do. Reacquaint yourself with this teaching. Come back to it. Contemplate it when it's being spoken. Read about it when you're reading about it. And sit and meditate is all we need to do. Just continue to do that with a wholehearted desire and intention to, you know, step into this moment, to be here completely. At some point we'll realize there's something more going on here than we've otherwise have understood. Then he gets into this very interesting discussion here of the Bodhisattva Four Vows. He said that in Zen, or he says Zen in everyday life is based on what we call living in vow, which we discussed in this course a few weeks ago, this matter of living in vow. But here he recites the four Bodhisattva vows. As they're normally stated, this is how I learned them, and they're most commonly stated this way. It's not the way we state them here, however. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But here he says, the way you're most often going to find them outside of Dharma field will be sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The Dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. And he said that these vows are very important. To live in vow is not to live by your own will or volition. These vows come from greater depths than personal volition or will. You know, they're coming out of the whole, and it's coming out of a mind of the whole. This is why we're going to have a conflict here, as he's going to bring out here in just a moment. He said, if you keep these vows in your daily life, you are what is called a bodhisattva, if you keep these vows in your daily life. But he said that when we say these vows in English, we say, I vow. And here's the problem. But bodhisattvas don't assert the I. Because a bodhisattva, this vow coming out of this deep place that he's speaking of, is not coming out of an ego. It's not coming out of a separate self. Not coming out of a mind confused and seeing itself separate from other, wanting to aggrandize self, to please self, to protect self, all the rest of that. It's not coming from such a mind at all. It's coming from a mind of the whole. And the voice that is speaking this is of a mind just such as that. Not coming from ego. So he said the bodhisattva's life is completely without subject and object, because in this case he's talking about a realized bodhisattva at this point. Sometimes you might understand a bodhisattva as any just to have the desire to wake up. If it's really an earnest and, you know, heartfelt true desire, already we are on the bodhisattva path, so we could say we're a bodhisattva. But here we're talking about a realized bodhisattva who actually understands how they live in this world, how they exist here. And so this bodhisattva's life is completely without subject and object. He said this is full concentration. But he says, when we say it in English, we say, I vow, and this is the problem. So when we were working on the vows here, some of you, I think, know these. We use them on Saturday morning anyway, but we've changed these. I wanted to get rid of this expression of I vow because it really is in conflict with the spirit and understanding of these vows and where they are coming from. So you know how we recite them here? I think most of you know these. To save all sentient beings, though they are numberless, to end all desires, though they are inexhaustible, to learn the teachings, though they are boundless, to live the Buddha way, though it is unsurpassable. And by the way, to live this Buddha way doesn't mean that you're going to live by some dictates of some fellow that lived in the past, you know, the Buddha. That's not what that means. We could say to live in enlightenment. To live the Buddha way is to live in enlightenment. And even though we might think, well, I don't know how to live in enlightenment, that's not what we're talking about. This is your aspiration. To live in each moment, to be here, to be awake, to be present. This is to live the Buddha way. And it is unsurpassable. There's nothing that can go beyond this. If you think about it just for a moment, just what that means, to truly be here, what more, what can surpass that? Nothing. This is the understanding of unsurpassable. But that's something you might want to just contemplate for a while. Okay, this last paragraph then. To become a bodhisattva, without the frame of a bodhisattva, to let yourself be fully alive, do not concentrate in the realm of ideas, philosophy, or psychology. Don't even concentrate in the realm of like or dislike. This is another important point to be mindful of. If you're caught up in, who isn't? We're easily caught up in our likes and dislikes. But once again, you start to notice how this removes us from reality, from what is really taking place. He says, just be alive. Just be alive. This is Zen in everyday life. Well, there's that section. Now we have the epilogue, which has some interesting things. I'll just keep going, and then I think maybe we'll have some time for questions here at the end. Zazen, the art of Zazen. Zazen is sitting meditation. I think maybe by now we all know that. And once again, here he says, you can't sit Zazen alone. You know, some people think that Zazen is, maybe you've heard that Zen is selfish. I hear this from time to time. People think, well, Zen is really selfish. You're just sitting there, you know, trying to enlighten yourself. Because we have this understanding, like Basho sitting there wanting to become a Buddha, wanting to become enlightened by sitting in meditation. And it's a very common understanding. But if people think that Zazen is selfish and that Zen practice is selfish, they're having that understanding is coming from this misunderstanding of Zen practice. And this misunderstanding is very widespread. And you're probably, after all we've said here, probably still holding shreds of it now, because it's deeply embedded in us, this selfishness, and that we will do things for a selfish, but this is the activity that is actually free from selfishness. And this is what this training is about, is to finally realize our way out of this entanglement that we get into with self, and all the confusion, pain, suffering that comes with it as well. So if you hear anybody say Zen is selfish, just tell them that it really is quite the opposite of that. It is liberation from such things. But you might not want to say much more than that, unless they press you, but there's probably not a whole lot you can say at that point. But maybe you can just assure them that, you know, they have the wrong idea. But this is, again, an important point. You can't sit Zazen alone. That is, you can't sit within an egoistic, selfish territory that is all your own. And he said, it's impossible. And I would invite you to consider what he just said here and to not think that he's just speaking or that he's just talking. I was pretty, from the moment I met him, I was pretty much, I really did take to heart pretty much what he said, or at least I thought I did. But he would say things, but I guess it wasn't complete, wasn't total, and he might make a statement like this. And I trusted him. I thought, yeah, he means it. But I don't know how to say this, but I want you to understand that he really means this, that these are not just words. When he says it's impossible, he means just that. If you are really doing this practice, then as he says it here, you can't sit alone. You can't have some egoistic idea. In other words, so you're sitting there, and don't let this discourage you, because just go ahead and sit there even with your egoistic idea. That's okay. You know, that's normal. But realize at some point that has got to go, and that don't try to push it out or anything. Just realize, if you really do this with an earnest heart, if you really want to get to the bottom of things and to wake up and to realize what this moment is, that will go. It will go of its own. You don't need to drive it out or push it out. All you need to do is, with an earnest desire, to learn to come back to this moment again and again, as he's going to describe it here. So he says, to sit Zazen with all beings is for all beings to sit Zazen with you. Same thing, goes both ways. Because there isn't you, there isn't all beings. You know, there's no separation here. But then he gets into pretty soon he gets into his descriptions here of Zazen. I guess we do have a little bit more here. He says, we have to make our best effort to sit Zazen without expecting anything extra. Oh, yeah, excuse me. And he says, if you expect something from your Zazen, even slightly, you can't do your best. So once again, see if you can do this. Just notice if there's some expectation in your Zazen. Just notice that, that's all. And let that get weaker and weaker and drop off. Then you really start doing Zazen at that point. Don't let that bother you, but you might think, well, I have to have some reason for doing this otherwise. Yeah, I know, that's our chronic problem, though, don't you see? That's why we stay entangled in ignorance and pain and suffering, confusion, not really understanding what's going on. It is that very issue. And so if you can learn to just continue to do the practice until this, you have some reason, some explanation for doing it, you're going to get something out of this, whatever, that will eventually weaken and drop off. But the problem is that when it gets so weak, but you're still used to it, that's what you're looking to, you're still reaching for something to help you and assist you in some way, you become so weak that eventually very many people leave. It's pretty normal. But if you get to that point, we have absolutely no reason to go on and to continue doing this. Go ahead and continue doing it anyway. And actually, if you can just get over a little bit of a hurdle there, you'd be amazed at how easy this practice suddenly becomes. Just to do it, day after day, for the rest of your life, no problem. But there's just that little hurdle there. You have to just kind of ride up over it. It might take a few years. You come up to it very slowly, keeps getting weaker and weaker, you just can't see any reason to go on. I almost quit three times. I almost quit, and when I was in this phase, and I'm very grateful for whatever reason I didn't quit, but came very close, totally resigned to quitting. Yeah, for a few hours, and then I had it. I after my first Orioki, that was it. No more of this. My first Sesshin, that's it. I no more of this. And then one other time, when I was just, I used to bike over to the Zendo in the early days there, and I remember going around the block about three times, thinking, I don't know, I've got other things to do tonight. And I finally went in, but you might have moments like this. And eventually, now I still have moments where maybe I don't want to get up, but it doesn't faze you anymore. If this is what you're going to do, whatever it is, and I don't mean just Zazen. You find out you have cancer, you don't want to go in for the chemotherapy, but that's what you're going to do. So you just do it, you don't complain, it's not a problem. And you can find a mind like that, but this is what we're talking about here. And it's possible to find that mind that isn't vacillating, isn't griping, isn't clinging, grasping, whatever. But that's what we're really talking about here. It's a subtle mind that is there. You already have it. It's just a matter of letting all of this nonsense about why you're doing this and what you're going to get out of it. For me, it's an ego thing. Just let that all just kind of dissolve away. And when it does, this pure Zazen mind will be right there. And it'll work in many aspects of your life, not just for your meditation. So he says, we have to make our best effort to sit Zazen without expecting anything extra. Okay, even slightly. He says, if you expect anything even slightly, then you can't do your best. He points out, what you've done here is you've created two goals. And normally we approach meditation with these two goals. There's the Zazen, and then we have the purpose of Zazen, the reason for why we're doing it. He says, if you want to do Zazen, just do Zazen. Just do Zazen without offering some explanation, even to yourself, as to why you're doing it. And quite honestly, to this day, I can't offer you a reason why I do it. All I know is that you're not going to get me to stop, I guess. I remember another kind of mind that I don't, I can't go back to it. But there is a different mind. And it's there. You already have it. It's not a matter that you need to find something. You just need to uncover it. That's all. But you know, we have, when we have reasons for doing Zazen, he says intellectually you want to know what Zazen, we have all these questions, you know, what's the result, you know, what do I get out of this? He says it's a very busy mind, but look at that mind. Just see, Zazen is always about, Zen itself is about just looking at where you are right now. Look at that very mind. When your mind is doing this, when you're looking for this explanation or what you're going to get out of it or what's the result of meditation, and, you know, look at the mind that is concerned with that. What kind of a mind? Is that an enlightened mind? No, of course not. It is a grasping mind. It is a disturbed mind, an unsettled mind, a worried mind. It's a, you know, it's a mind in pain and suffering, confusion, wanting, not satisfied with where it is, but needs to be somewhere else. But that's impossible. You can't be somewhere else. You have to learn to be content with right where you are. There's no explanation for that. So he said, just simply jump into Zazen. If you do Zazen after hearing that, it makes you calm. He says, then you start doing Zazen. So if you need some reason, you know, well, Zazen will make you calm. So now you have some reason for doing Zazen. But you know, Zazen doesn't make you calm. You sit there with monkey mind. Your mind is very busy. It's just jumping all over the place, very agitated. You might find this. Well, of course, isn't Zazen that's doing that to you? That mind's been with you all along. You've just uncovered it, that's all. And so is it going to go away if you never look at that? No, the way that that mind will calm down is you start to notice what is actually taking place there and acquaint yourself with this agitated, grasping monkey mind. The mind itself, the actual pure mind that lies beneath all of this, is quite calm. It's just a matter of finding that. But we're usually floating around up here on the surface. There's a lot of agitation, and we might put a lid on it. And you sit in Zazen for a few minutes, the lid comes off, and then you notice there's all this disturbance, you know. So if your reason for sitting Zazen was a calm mind, you're probably going to leave. But don't leave. Just give up on that as a reason. You'll find your calm mind soon enough. Okay, but then he gets into these three basic points of Zazen. He said, first, harmonizing the body. Second, harmonizing the mind. And third, harmonizing the breath. And this is just basically straightforward Zazen instruction for the most part. So I won't go into it. I've given this plenty of places, and you can always take it here on a Thursday night or whenever we offer it. So I don't think I need to go into this here, except there are a few points I do want to bring out. 168, where he says, harmonizing the body also means you have to arrange your external circumstances. The room you do Zazen in should not be messy or dirty. It shouldn't be too bright or too dark, not too hot or too cold and drafty. He said, make your external circumstances pleasant and comfortable, but I might want to add, but not too comfortable. You know, like, don't put in a downy bed and lie back and you're going to do your Zazen. You know, you can make it too cushy, and that's probably not so good either. Just avoid any kind of extremes, but you should be reasonably comfortable and quiet and focused. Not too bright, not too dark. So basically just avoid the extremes. Whatever duality seems to loom up there, just avoid going one way or another with it. Sometimes people think they need to make it very austere. Well, you know, you don't need to do that either. He said, then another thing I want to bring out, where he says, slowly rock your body, you know, right and left. And he says, slowly lean your body to the left as you exhale, dropping your head toward your left shoulder. And I just want to point this out because I don't normally speak of this. And I notice sometimes when people are doing the sways from side to side, they'll kind of lean forward, you know, like this. But just lean straight off to the side and drop the head. That is the instruction here. You can lean forward, but do that as a, you know, separate action. But basically, it's just lean from side to side. And then he says, when you put the two hands, well, I don't think I have things to say there. The eyes, yeah, the eyes should be slightly open. This is probably a point just to emphasize, because this is a tricky point for a lot of people. If you close your eyes, you'll experience visual images. You know, you start daydreaming. And he said, they might be fun, but you'll create distractions for yourself. If you open your eyes too wide, that's also trouble. your mind will scatter. So yeah, this is a very important point. I think sometimes, again, people, you take these basic instructions and then you modify it. You modify it to suit you. Well, I kind of do it like this. Realize, just look at what you're doing now. It's that ego stepping into the picture again. And if you're going to bring that ego deliberately into the meditation in that way, that's what you're going to be. You're going to be caught and dwelt. You're going to be stuck with that. And so better to just be watching that. And these are the simple instructions. They've been found to be very effective over millennia, you know, people practicing in this way. And there's a very clear reason for why to keep the eyes open, which is becoming pretty obvious to me now. After 30 years, I'm starting to see more and more about this eyes opening. It's a very important point, and I would make that effort. I know it's easy. You want to close the eyes. It feels better. It's more comfortable, whatever. We habitually will do something like that. But keep those eyes open. Just work on that a little bit. You can close them, he says here. You can close them a little bit for a while if you need to, but open them again. Of course, you can blink. It doesn't mean to freeze your eyes open in some way, but, you know, blink. Forget judgment. Another very important point, because if judgment is in the mind, you're not doing zazen. That's just judgment. If you're truly awake, you can't be judging. You're also seeing very clearly what's going on. You're seeing others quite well, but at the same time, there's no judgment going on there. And for you, in meditating too, you don't need to worry about others, because if anybody is judging you, then they don't see you. They might think they do. Of course they think they do, because they're judging you, but they don't really see you. Anybody who does see you, they're not judging you. It's as simple as that. So you don't need to worry about judgment. Only a fool is judging, and the wise aren't judging, so you have nothing to worry about. He says, usually your mind is very busy, top of page 171. It's just like a monkey leaping about from here to there. Well, we all know this, I think, huh? He says, so you must take care of it. He said, let your mind sit in zazen. This is the point. This is what zazen is. It is what is happening with the mind, okay? The other day I was talking about this. I was talking about it last week, too, that we talk about zazen as sitting. Well, of course it's sitting, you know. But we emphasize that too much, and then we forget that what we're really talking about is the mind. And we shouldn't lose sight of that. He said, let your mind sit in zazen. Don't let it go. Okay. If you let it go, it runs wild. Don't let it go. Well, what this means is, you know, just don't let it go. It sounds kind of maybe a little too aggressive or something. But what he's saying here is just stay with it. Just stay with it. It's like when the TV comes on in your mind, you know, and then you're distracted, you know. You're hearing things in your mind's ear, and you're seeing things in your mind's eye, and you're thinking things, and you're having conversations with people that aren't there, and, you know, hopefully quietly, you know. But you know, all of this is going on, and of course, you're sitting here quietly. You know, the TV is switched on. Just come back to this. When he says stay with it, or when he says, what does he say? Don't let go. Just, you know, bring yourself, you know, back to this. Just stay here. Turn that TV of the mind off. And he said, let whatever kind of mind you have, monkey mind, good mind, calm mind, just let it sit with you. Yeah. So don't be obsessed, or, you know. So the things might continue to work up in your mind, but to bring yourself back, to stay with it, is to what? It's to stay with the breath. He says, to do this, he said, your mind should be with your breath. So just if through all of the talking, the that's going on in your mind, whatever's happening there, just as best you can, just to retain that awareness of the breath. Stay with the breath. To the extent that you can stay with the breath, that talking, that agitation of mind, whatever it is, will begin to settle out, quiet down, become more transparent. And so this is a pretty important point until we learn to actually find that quiet mind and begin cultivating it. He said, your mind should be with your breath, a little further down on page 171. Often, however, it will leave at that time. Bring it back to your Zazen. This is very, but this is all Zazen is. Your mind will leave and then you just bring it back. This is really all we're doing. I don't think it's a lot more than that, but that's quite a bit to develop and cultivate that quality mind of mind to realize that you've wandered and now come back. And even to cultivate the desire, or at least the ability, to let yourself just come back. Sometimes there's a lot of resistance there at the beginning. He says, very often your mind is like a wild kid, always running about. Then you should just be like a mother, always bringing the kid back. And you love the kid. You don't scold the kid. It's just not a bad kid. It's just a kid. And kids do this. That's your mind. Your mind's just like a kid. Runs around, and that's perfectly normal, but at some point we want to cultivate some maturity, maturity of mind. Okay, so just bring it back. He said, I don't know how often you will have to do this. He said, maybe for the whole period of Zazen, or maybe for 10 years. But just do this, When you see your mind going out and coming back, you'll eventually ask, what is Zazen? What is this anyway? He said, but don't worry. All you have to do is to learn to see where your mind is. And if it goes out, bring it back. Very simple. This is all we have to do. This is the art of Zazen. So that doesn't sound like much, but that's quite a bit right there. If you really get the spirit and taste of that, that'll serve you quite well. On the last page, in 172, he said, even though you sit in Zazen every day, ego can still be a problem. You can become proud of your practice. Wherever you go, you may insist on doing Zazen. So wherever you go, you go visit the relatives or whatever, but you're a Zen practice, so you bring your Zazen with you, and you insist that everybody, be quiet now. It's my Zazen time, And I've known people to do this, You might think that this is this, but I gotta have my Zazen now. Every day, I gotta, No, you don't. No, you don't have to do that. Under these circumstances, unusual circumstances, you're with these people, something else has happened. At this opening, the prologue to this book where he talks about daily routine and then unexpected occurrences. Oftentimes you might be in some other situation. Just let that go. What is your Zazen anyway? Is it to go in there and to cause a lot of trouble, to disturb people? This is something very rigid and brittle. It is not the kind of mind that we're cultivating in Zazen. But somehow we get kind of the mind of a zealot here, where we feel like we have to be disciplined, we become proud of our practice, we identify with it, we have to be. We'll just be watching that. The Zazen is about watching what kind of mind are you in, and notice that mind when it is creeping in. This is all we're doing. And if your momentary circumstances don't allow you to sit down on a cushion without causing a lot of trouble, then don't do it. Besides, you can sit Zazen in a chair or on a walk or having a conversation. You can cultivate that as well. So he says, you may kick out anyone who interferes with your Zazen. No, don't, I've known people to do this. He says, you might stop caring about your family, your schooling, your job, your office, and just take care of, you just care about your Zazen. He said, sometimes people do these things, but it's all just egoism. And so just be watchful of that. Realize that this is not the way to practice Zazen. This is just to be a zealot. This is just to have a brittle mind. He said, this is not right practice. Day by day, just do Zazen quietly. Do Zazen quietly. Not for show, he says, without any expectations. Avoid doing Zazen for show. And doing it quietly day after day, and sometimes people might think that, very often we think that, what can I say? Not, but we will do it, we'll do it you know, just for the wrong reasons. And what we're really talking about, just to do it quiet. If you do it quietly, day after day, anybody who can see you will realize what you're doing, and you don't need to do it, you know, for show. If you are doing it for show, that will also be obvious, and people will see what you're doing. So you see, just keep, and you're not doing Zazen at all. If you're doing it not for show, if you're just doing it quietly, if you're really doing that, this will also be obvious. I can see that. And then you are actually doing Zazen, and you just continue to do it without expectation day after day. And he said, just keep Zazen modestly as a religious practice. And if it becomes kind of showy, you know, this also gets amplified, by the way. Anybody who gets ordained, this really becomes amplified. If you have any kind of stinkiness in your mind, it really gets exaggerated. If anybody's looking at you when you're doing your Zazen. But whether you're ordained or not, it doesn't matter. Just do it quietly. And do it quietly within your own mind. That's where you have to do it quietly. That's what we're talking about, actually. You don't quite realize, maybe, just how noisy your mind is in terms of how it looks, you know. And when you're sitting in Zazen, and if you're proud in your Zazen, you know, this also begins to show right there in your posture as you're sitting. So what he's really talking about here, though, is just finding that quiet mind, that mind that is not doing this, you know, for some particular purpose, for some kind of aggrandizement. He said, if you attach to the good experiences you get through Zazen, you will create expectations of enlightenment. He said, then you won't be peaceful because you would just want more and more and more. Actually, yeah, it's just a usual mind. He said, if you get the idea that Zazen is wonderful, this is just the experience of wanting more. It is not Zazen. So, you know, just don't get hung up on thinking Zazen is wonderful. But besides that, you'll end up discouraging yourself. You know, Zazen isn't wonderful. Zazen isn't anything at all in particular, really. Zazen is just to be here present with reality and not to be, you know, confused by it. He said, if you're confused in your Zazen, you're not at peace. But peace is exactly what Zazen is. You know, so we do have that calm mind then in Zazen. But we're talking about actually doing Zazen after this busy monkey mind has evaporated. He said, if you just realize that all you have to do is to harmonize your mind, your body, and your breath, then you will learn to be present beyond your likes and dislikes. Beyond your likes and dislikes. Another important point not to lose sight of. He said, furthermore, you'll realize great vitality. You'll know true peace and tranquility. And finally, at the end, he said, Zazen is to realize exactly who you are. Exactly who you are. And this is all you have to do. Just realize exactly who you are. I'll tell you, exactly who you are is no one in particular. But you can realize that. That's exactly who you are. Well, we do have a few minutes, so any questions? If you think you are someone in particular, that's your problem. That's the problem we suffer from. It's not your problem. We all have that problem. But Zazen, if you really do Zazen, in doing Zazen, right there in the doing of the Zazen, when you realize exactly who you are, there's no one in particular there. Exactly doing Zazen, inseparable from other. There's no self and other. There's no subject and object, as he said. This is exactly who you are. This is true. It's called true self, or big mind, or true, you know, true mind, or whatever. True self, big self. So we have these expressions too in Zen. But this is what you can realize, and this is to realize exactly who you are, exactly what you are. Short of that, you know, we have a lot of ideas about the self. So we think, too, that if you're going to learn exactly who you are, we might think of it in terms of, you know, that we're going to get some idea about ourselves. And I hope when I find out it's going to be okay. I mean, I hope I'm not as bad as I'm worried that I might be, you know. And, you know, you don't need to worry. You don't need to worry about that. You wake up to exactly what you are. You're no better, no worse than anything else. Of course, when we have an ego, we think, oh, no, well, I don't want to be. I want to be above average. You know, we want to live in a town where everyone's above average, and I want to be even a little bit better than that. You know? Yeah. But that's our problem once again. Yeah, Jay.
When you're sitting zazen and you're focusing on your breath, and you also talk about examining that question, who are you? Exactly who are you?
No, you're not examining that.
But that's my question is mm-hmm. related to that. You also say to look at that question.
I do?
Well, I thought you did anyway, maybe. Okay. What I'm trying to get at is there are several things understanding our experience,
mm-hmm.
and we're not, we're supposed to be coming back to our breath, but it's difficult not to examine what's going on too in our experience at that time,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it's just a very subtle aspect of Zazen, but there's a point where you also notice what's going on, and that's taken away from your breath also. So there's a subtle line there, and
this is what I meant by what is taking place there. If you just stay with the breath, it becomes whatever else is happening in the mind becomes kind of transparent. It isn't. You can stay with the breath and still have your monkey mind. You know, it's like what he said here. Yeah, you can just sit with your monkey mind, but stay. Don't lose sight of the breath. Of course, if you're experiencing a lot of monkey mind, you lose track of the breath. You're not likely to realize that you've done that now because you're caught up in your monkey mind. That's quite true. But the moment you do, you just come back, and that mind is still kind of spinning there. Don't worry about that. Just stay with the breath. If you learn to let that become stronger, just strengthen that. Your ability, that's just your concentration, to stay here. That will strengthen this monkey mind, the thoughts, feelings, whatever that's going on in the mind. That becomes even more transparent, you know, gradually over time. At some point it weakens enough. Well, yeah, it could drop away, you know, but it still shows up again. But at some point, the quality of the mind changes. At some point, you will realize what you're doing. And that will change. You'll understand what Zazen is. If you understood what Zazen is, if people... I wish I could just, I don't know, snap my fingers or something so people could realize what this was. Because if you did realize what this was, nothing would stop you from practicing. But because we don't realize, everything stops us. I mean, just any little thing can stop us from practicing. You know, even when we really have a desire to do it. But of course, again, our desire to do it very often is misguided. You know, we got that gaining idea. We're going to get something out of this. You know, unfortunately, that's the wrong motive. You know, any motive is the wrong motive. But in the process of doing this meditation, eventually, these kinds of things weaken, just like those busy thoughts. It all weakens. That's where these things are taking place. This motive, this idea for why you're doing that. It's all in that busyness of mind that weakens. Eventually, that can drop away, and you still practice. But if you're practicing like this, then you'll actually understand what it is that you're doing. And you would never exchange that mind for a mind that doesn't understand this. And of course, if you actually do understand, you won't, because the mind does not subtract. It doesn't go backwards. You cannot not know something once you know it. I'm not talking about conceptual knowledge. You know, we can forget things. You know, I used to know how to do certain kinds of things that I don't know. I'm getting old enough now, I'm beginning to realize how much I've forgotten. You know, every once in a while I run into things and used to know this. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just actually seeing reality, see what is going on here. You know, that doesn't go away. It doesn't drop off. I don't know if that helped you at all, Jay, or. But just be aware that realize that you can stay with, you can follow the breath. It doesn't, you know, because you to think about it, can you really follow your breath and that's all you're doing? Nothing else is happening in your mind? I don't think so. No, there's a lot of stuff going on probably. So don't think that we somehow have to get into this pure state of mind where we're just following the breath, because actually that's not the point at all, really. But it, just stay with the breath. Just, you know, and allow the mind to quiet down with this, you know, awareness of the breath. And the mind, if you can just stay with that, the mind will begin to quiet down. It might take some time, but gradually that will begin to happen.
Yeah, very helpful, though. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I think people think they have to drive everything out and now I can stay with them. No, no, don't worry about it. Just stay with the breath no matter what else is happening in the mind. You know, and if you just, you know, and that's all this is. So your mind's wandered from the breath, bring it back. It's wandered from the breath, bring it back. As soon as you notice it's wandered, just bring it back. That's all we're doing. In the process of doing that, gradually that other stuff weakens. Your concentration increases. The quality of the breath or observation of the breath, this begins to change drastically after a while. But that's something else, in the, you know, that's shikantaza.
A little bit. When you're doing this, it's hard not to, and you're not. I know you're not supposed to be judgmental, but it's hard not to observe a little bit what's going on in your mind and begin to...
What do you mean, in terms of judgment?
Judgment, mate, just observe it.
Not to observe it, yeah, but that's
right.
Not judgment.
Okay, that was interesting.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, yeah, something happens, you say, wow, that was interesting. All right, that's what happened.
Right.
And you said, wow, that was interesting. You know, yes. Next moment, just, you know. I mean, of course, we can think, what does it mean that was interesting, you know? Was it really interesting? Well, what was it anyway? You know, we can go on and on with this. In the meantime, the breath, we're still breathing, but we're not paying, you know. I mean, the point is just to come back to the breath, no matter what else the mind. But if you stay with the breath, too, your inclination to pursue all these other kinds of tangential, you know, thoughts and things, it does weaken and drop away. You'll all start to recognize how it is that all of these things, these very interesting, deep philosophical or psychological or whatever pursuits that we're following in the mind, really go nowhere. You ever notice that? You know that, though, don't you? I mean, all that mental activity that we experience day in and day out. Okay, you live 20, 30, 40 years. Where's it gone? Where's it gotten you? I mean, it's just, you know, and what was it? It just keeps going on, you know, just... we think somehow we're going to put something together here, but we never do. And then we keep looking for the truth in that. You see, and that's just, you know, enlightenment, reality. We don't find it there. Usually when we come to a class like this, we're very suspicious of that. You know, yeah, we're not going to find it there. But our habit of doing that is so powerful, so strong. It takes some doing for us to start catch on to what it is that we're doing and how it is that we keep taking one misstep after another. But gradually we can learn this. Well, we have gone over, so I probably should end it. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.